You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the host of the popular podcast Death, Sex, and Money joins us for a look at how we can have better conversations with the people in our lives, especially when it comes to the hard stuff to talk about. Now, jobs numbers in April were a lot lower than expected. Instead of 1 million jobs added, it was just over 250,000. Why? There's lots of ideas out there. Some of it may have to do with continued reluctance to return to work for health reasons, as just about 40% of Americans are fully vaccinated. Business groups and Republicans have pointed at a boost in unemployment benefits as an incentive for people not to get a job. And a Pew Research Center survey found that over 60% of unemployed people had seriously considered changing careers. It's caused many to reassess what they want from life, including what they want from work, and that might contribute to a lag in a job rebound. We're talking now about the most recent job numbers and recovering jobs lost during the pandemic. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you lose your job sometime during the pandemic? Where are you at now? Are there jobs you would do, but the wages are too low? If you're looking for work or looking for workers, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Menzi Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. Menzi, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
I remember back in the rebound from the Great Recession, looking at the monthly job reports every month, and 250,000 for a long time there would have looked like a really good report. Why does it look like a really bad report last month?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is that we've been attuned to these big rebounds in employment in, you know, hundreds of thousands, multiple hundreds of thousands for several months. That was one reason. But on top of that, the forecasters had been expecting something on the order, as you mentioned, of 1 million jobs created. So 266,000 non-farm payroll jobs, while not a bad number, was just a big surprise. And so now we have to parse out the data and figure out what does it mean?
Yeah. All right. Parse out the data for us, Menzi. What does this mean?
Well, let me just go through the possibilities or the possible explanations. One is that just the recovery is slowing down because there's not enough demand for labor because demand for goods and services is it's slowing its increase. The second category would be its supply factors, like perhaps the unwillingness of people to work because of generous benefits or because they face constraints in terms of childcare. The third possibility is it's something statistical, and that is perhaps because we have difficulty counting exactly the number of people who are employed. Remember, you have to call up firms and take a poll, and you're only getting a sample, and you may miss a representative sample when you construct this poll. In addition, there's these distortions when you take into account the seasonality of the data, and you try to take care of it as best you can, but the big drop in employment in March and April of last year could make that more difficult over time. So there are a variety of explanations that are possible, and then we have to try to figure out which ones are more plausible than others.
Let's dig in the one that's been the most politically controversial. As I mentioned, groups like the Chamber of Commerce and Republicans are saying we've got these enhanced unemployment benefits. And maybe they were okay when the economy wasn't recovering. But now the argument is the extra money is an incentive to not work, or at least it's making people more reluctant to work at the lower wage jobs. How do we measure something like that? How do we figure out if there's something to that?
Well, that's actually quite difficult because you have to cobble together information from several disparate sources, and there's not anything that just says, well, we're not working because, well, it's better to be on enhanced unemployment insurance. I think the fact that long-term unemployment came down and sort of the claims for new unemployment insurance didn't go up, these sort of count against that factor being important in April's numbers. And remember, these numbers pertain to the roughly the second week of April. So this is a ways back already. On the other hand, you can look at the composition of new jobs, at least coming from the household survey. Okay, so different from the establishment survey, which is essentially surveying businesses. When you ask people, what we find is that most or essentially all of the net new jobs were male, respondents, whereas actual female employment went down. And so that's sort of circumstantial evidence to suggest, well, if you thought it was unemployment insurance generosity that was driving things, why would you see this sort of pattern of employment gains? So that leads us to a possible alternative view, which is maybe it has something to do with the constraints that people, households face in terms of, let's say, childcare or taking care of parents and so forth. So the politically charged argument that you mentioned, maybe that will come to pass in the future. Maybe that'll be relevant. It's not clear. I'm not ruling it out, but it's not clear that that was particularly relevant in April.
Talking to Menzi Chen, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at jobs and employment and unemployment in the United States. April job numbers positive, but nowhere near as positive as people had been predicting or hoping. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you out of work? How is the job search going? Are you an employer? Are you able to find people to do the jobs you need done? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Menzi, let's hit on that point you just brought up there. Women in particular not getting back into jobs. And you mentioned the concerns of things like childcare or and caring for parents and things like that. And of course, the pandemic itself isn't over. Could you talk about a little more about why that might be holding jobs down?
Well, the fact of the matter is that for a long time in the United States, we've had concerns about labor participation rates being constrained somewhat by virtue of the fact that a lot of the things that we need, for instance, to enable people to go to work haven't been there, you know. And so childcare, I think, has taken on greater importance, including in terms of with schools being closed. That is a constraint that falls disproportionately on certain members of each household. And so until we deal with that issue going forward, it's not clear to me that we can get back completely to normal in terms of labor force participation. And anyways, it just goes to show, I mean, the very sharp disjuncture in terms of the labor gains seems to point at that. I'll also note that, you know, sectorally, one of the big places where you have a pretty rapid increase in employment was in accommodation and food services. And so I don't know about the gender breakdown in terms of employment there. But what's true is where we've seen tightness in the labor market the most and where firms are talking a lot about not being able to hire people at the wages that they were offering previously is exactly in that area. So if you're saying, well, we should have expected more jobs to be created, well, maybe there would have been more sort of from the supply side if people felt like they could leave home to go to work.
Another issue people are pointing to, and I'm not sure if it's something that would actually affect jobs yet, but maybe it is bottlenecks in supply chains for things. I hear from my family in Michigan, there are parking lots full of cars that are complete except for computer chips that there's a shortage of. We hear about high costs of lumber because of bottlenecks in converting timber into lumber, other raw materials, other finished goods. Is this a problem we're having, and what effect would it have on jobs?
So that's an interesting point. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we've had a somewhat big change in the character of the U.S. economy in the sense that we're now producing, or we have been up to this point, reoriented more towards production of goods rather than delivery of services. And so, you know, the chip issue had to do with the fact that chip production or chip orders were reduced when demand for cars went down, and now demand for cars and has gone back up, and it's taking time to ramp up production to this new elevated level. So at some point, because you can't keep on making cars that don't have the chips so that you can sell them off, they'll want to reduce the pace of production, and that's gonna limit employment. On the other hand, you know, some of this is, it's not clear that it has a direct impact on employment. So, for instance, lumber prices rising because of this big boom in renovation and construction Now, it's not clear to me how that affects employment directly, except it has ramifications for inflation more generally, which we can come to later. In general, these things are going to, both of them will tend to raise prices, or upward pressure on prices will be enhanced. It's unclear to me how sustained they'll be. So do you need to worry about prices of goods rising a lot due to these factors in and of themselves? The fact that wage rates are rising is also another issue. I mean, we see tightness in, for instance, once again, accommodation and food services. And so right now, the firms are having a hard time getting the labor they need, but presumably wages will continue to adjust upwards. And if you have a resolution or some sort of solution to childcare problems and other constraints, then that bottleneck can be relieved. So I don't have a clear answer for you. We have these one-time shocks in certain sectors that are going to tend to push up prices and push up some wages. And it remains to be seen how persistent those will be.
We're talking to Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at last month's lower than expected job numbers. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you looking for work? Are you looking to hire people? How is that going? And has the pandemic made you rethink what you want in a job? Are you planning on switching careers? Have you already done it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Madison economist Menzie Chin about April's low job numbers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Peggy is with us in Casco. Peggy, hi. Oop, are you there, Peggy?
Yes, I'm here.
What do you want to tell us about?
Okay, I have two things. It was like 13 years ago that I left a good-paying job, and I was collecting $317 a week, and there was not a single job out there that paid as much as my unemployment. And I don't think that's any different now, especially since the government refuses to take away that extra money. That's part of the problem we're having.
And the other thing, Peggy?
Okay. The second comment is I should be retired, but I have people actually calling me looking to see if I'll work. I have a state park camp store that cannot find help. I work at a vegetable farm whose main cash crop is strawberries. They cannot find pickers. And I'm at a grocery store that's crying for help. It's just unreal. There is nobody out there that wants to work.
Peggy, thanks for the call. Menzie, we see a lot of viral signs on stores saying what Peggy ended with there, nobody wants to work. What do you think?
Well, first of all, what do they teach you in introductory economics is supply and demand, and wages can rise in order to match quantity supply to quantity demanded. So in some sense, there's not enough people taking up the jobs because the wages aren't sufficiently high. Now, why does the wage need to be higher than it used to be? One of the reasons is possibly the enhanced unemployment insurance benefits, which are going to expire eventually. That might be part of it, although we don't have evidence to indicate that that's a big factor. The other one is, for those people who are not vaccinated, or those people who have the constraints that they do with family care or child care and so forth, well, maybe that's just a hard constraint, which makes it difficult for them to take the jobs, even at the wages that might be higher than they were before. In terms of picking fruit and so forth, we do know that the restrictions that were in place in terms of immigration and movement of labor across the border, I mean, we tightened up a lot there. And so agricultural concerns have long mentioned that this was a constraint. And it's not surprising that you know, as time goes on, those constraints are being felt even as the labor market tightens everywhere else. So it's hard to apportion, you know, sort of importance to each of these factors, but I think they're all there. And what we will see is something that we sort of expected was eventually wages will rise as the economy recovers. And part of getting people employed will be for wages to rise from long, low levels to higher levels.
Thanks for that call, Peggy. We'll go to John now in La Crosse. John, hi. John? I think we may have lost John. Let's try Mike on his way into Milwaukee now. Mike, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mike?
Hey, I just wanted to bring up a point. You mentioned something about the supply chain, mm-hmm. and that it, you know, that there might be some little bulges in there. And I actually completely disagree with that. I believe that the supply chain is broken right now, and it's going to be quite some time before it is fixed. That microchip issue that you're seeing that made really good news headlines, and that's why everybody is talking about it. But any multi-component part assembly, everybody is getting a lesson in where all of those components come from, and they are worldwide. So if the factory was in Taiwan that still might be shut down, you may not be getting your widget in order to complete this component. And we're going to see this effect in the supply chain for, I would say, next year at this time.
You're thinking about this a lot, Mike. Is this affecting your work?
It's a fact that it is very near and dear to my heart. I worked in supply chain for over 15 years. Ironically, was let go in fourth quarter, during some COVID cuts. I was in upper management and in the sourcing standpoints of supply chain. And I happen to have a patent on a component, a part that is a multi-component part that my order is tremendously delayed because of this thing.
Interesting. Mike, thanks a lot for sharing your up-close experience there. Menzi, what do you think? There might be some components, Mike says, that it's going to be a long time before the supply chain gets fixed.
Well, I think that's an important issue, and it's one that's not completely knowable. Most of the analyses that I see can't make a definitive answer about how sustained these problems are going to be. Right now, the microchip issue is, you know, largely hitting one sector that's important to the economy is automobiles. Other parts of the supply chain, when you talk about lumber, well, lumber is important, for instance, but it's not, for enough high enough price, you can still get the lumber. And so it's a question about not stopping production, but just making production or construction more expensive. But I do think that what this has all forced us to do is to think a little bit about how we trade off the cost effectiveness of having really lean supply chains with only a few producers of each particular good, and having something that where you diversify your sourcing more broadly, and maybe you have a little bit less cost effectiveness all along the supply chain. Right now you have to think about there being a whole sort of sequence of shocks that are going to actually slow down the economy and at the same time accelerate inflation. And so far we haven't seen that, but one never knows. I mean, one didn't know that there was going to be a ransomware attack on a pipeline. That you can still see that it probably will be resolved soon, but if you have a whole sequence of events like that, as the economy booms and you get closer to everybody running at close to capacity, that could happen. That could be a concern.
Mike, thanks for that call. Carolyn joins us next in Southwest Wisconsin. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. I thought I would mention that I actually was laid off during the pandemic because I was working for a small, creative, very fantastic artistic company that designed artwork for hospitals. But I think what happened there was I was the newest employee, and I also was the only one that had a child that was in a school level. So I had to start working from home completely and homeschooling. And so they did finally decide to lay me off because I couldn't fulfill my 40 hours or my salaried hours, which I think was frustrating on both sides. But that was unfortunate. And now here I am. I have a master's degree and trying to find a new position in the arts or art administration is, you know, it's a bit difficult. And okay. So, yeah.
I'm going to jump in, Carolyn. We don't have a lot of time left. Menzi, I think a lot of people in Carolyn's position may be thinking about a new line of work. What are you watching for as people come back to the work world but maybe have to or want to try something different just in our last minute?
Well, you know, I'm sorry to have heard of your troubles there. And it is, I mean, what's true is that the economy is going to be coming back, but some parts of it are going to be drastically changed. It's not clear to me that the portion of professional services that was being mentioned here would be it. I mean, you can imagine that accommodation and food services, for instance, with a big change in working from home and telecommunicating, is going to be altered substantially, you know, location-wise, possibly a way of delivery. So the labor force is going to experience some mismatch on the way up to, you know, the recovery of the overall economy. Just remember, I mean, we're still over 8 million jobs below where we were just before the pandemic struck. So there's still quite a bit of adjustment to occur, and compositional effects are going to be important, I think.
Menzi, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Menzi Chen, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, joining us for a look at the latest in job numbers. Coming up, we'll talk to Anna Sale about her new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the National Youth Poet Laureate Program is about to choose its next honoree. Jen White meets three of this year's finalists. Plus, you'll hear from U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, there are some things that are almost always hard to talk about. And our next guest says we're losing a lot of the institutional support systems that used to help us talk about them. That means it's up to us to choose to have or not to have conversations about things like death, sex, and money. And though they may be uncomfortable conversations, ultimately they could help us feel more connected to the people in our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's a time in your life when you've had to have a difficult conversation, big or small? Did you do it or did you avoid it? Did it make a difference if you had that conversation? Do you tend to avoid these tough conversations? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anna Sale is the creator and host of Death, Sex, and Money, the podcast from WNYC Studios, where she's been conducting interviews about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more since 2014. Before that, she covered politics for public radio for years, and her new book is called Let's Talk About Hard Things. Anna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you've got these universal issues that are going to affect our lives at some point or another: death, sex, money, and in the book, family and identity. Why are so many of us so bad and maybe so reluctant when it comes to talking about them?
Oh, I think there's lots of reasons. One reason is because we don't have a lot of practice. You know, a lot of us grow up being taught that bringing up hard or uncomfortable things is impolite. So it's something we have to learn how to do. And I also think that for a lot of us, we sort of avoid these conversations because we have the expectation that if we are going to talk about something hard, like someone's grief, or maybe the fact that, you know, you have more financial comfort than a close friend of yours. You avoid those conversations because it's not something that a conversation is going to fix or change. The hard thing is still going to be hard. But I make the argument in the book that, like, you don't have to have the expectation that talking about something, you have to have a solution or something that's going to make something not a problem anymore. Instead, when you have a conversation where you're sort of describing something tough that either you or your conversation is going, or your conversation partner is going through, if you describe it to each other, just kind of show up for each other, not pretend that something uncomfortable is not happening, then something else happens, which is, you know, you're able to support each other in a more meaningful way.
Beyond the fear that that conversation isn't going to magically fix everything, which, okay, I buy that there. There's a fear, I think it's a common Midwestern thing, I'll speak for myself, that I'm going to make it worse, that I'm going to say the wrong thing in a conversation, especially about somebody else's difficult situation, grief or what have you. How do we overcome that and avoid doing that too?
Oh, that's interesting that you think it's a Midwestern thing to be extra self-conscious and think that you're going to be destructive, not just that you're going to cause more problems. I'm from the Southern U.S. and we don't talk directly about tough things. I didn't grow up doing that in my family either. But I think that, like, it's all about showing your intent to the person you're talking to, you know, even saying, you know, a lot of us, unfortunately, have had more practice talking about grief lately because of how much loss there has been around us during this pandemic. And even saying, like, you know, I wish I could say something. I'm finding myself, like, wishing I could say something that would be a comfort to you. And I know there's nothing I can say that's going to fix this, but I just want you to know I'm thinking about you and I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, you know? But I think that, like, once you start that conversation, then that conversation about loss, say you're talking about someone who has died, you might have a conversation where you say, you know, I want to tell you what I remember about him. I want to tell you a memory I have, you know? Or if it's someone who's lost someone you didn't know personally. One tip that someone told me recently that I really love, if someone says, oh, my father just passed away. If you don't know what to say, one thing you can say is, oh, what was his name? And then you can sort of see what happens. The person you're talking to, they're given an opening to honor and to remember out loud this person that they are thinking about. They're just having to think about silently because people don't know how to talk about it.
You gave a really good example in the book, in the section on death, a woman who had lost her husband in a horrible, tragic accident, and had gotten lots of non-helpful stuff, even for professionals who kind of deal with these issues, and just kind of an acquaintance made a really good connection. Can you share that story?
Yeah, this is a woman named Megan Devine, who's a grief therapist herself. And she noted, like, among the people who were saying the wrong thing to her, she felt like after she lost her partner were fellow therapists, that she felt like people were coming to them saying something that was going to be helpful so they would feel less helpless in the face of loss, instead of just saying, I'm really sorry. Like, instead of just being with her and validating the sadness and grief. And she told a story of being in a coffee shop line waiting for a coffee. And the owner of a local bookstore kind of walked up to her. She didn't know him well. And he just said two things. He said, you know, I didn't know your partner, Matt, well. I didn't know him well, but I was always impressed with him. And then he said, and you know, grief is something, it's going to take a lot longer to feel normal than you think it will, or something to that. So just kind of like nodding to her about having a familiarity with loss himself and that she didn't need to present that she was okay. And she found it really comforting just to have someone sort of say, wherever you are and whatever you're feeling right now is okay. You're going through a profound loss. And Megan, just think about it. Megan described, you know, she lost her partner suddenly. And she said, you know, I was in a period where every ounce of my energy was just trying to wrap its head around the shattering reality that my partner was gone. I had no energy. And I found that in these social interactions where people were trying to make me feel better, I was feeling that I needed to show that I was feeling better so that they would feel okay. Mm-hmm. And instead, you know, just be, if we can just try to be the friend who just doesn't take that energy, that instead can say something like, you know, I'm going to take your dog for a walk a couple of times a week. Here's how I'm going to help you, you know. Or just the friend who sends a text and says, you're on my mind, we don't have to talk. I just want to let it, just tell me that you're okay. And she had that with a friend because a friend was worried about her, was worried how she was doing. And they developed this texting habit where Megan would just text back an asterisk to show that she was there, but just appreciating having time on her own.
We're talking to Anna Sale about her new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things. You can join in if you have a question, maybe a story of your own at 800-642-1234. Anna, one thing that can come up in many of the categories of your book, with family members or debates over money or in a tough relationship, the tough conversations where there's a grievance, maybe a mutual grievance. I have a problem with you. You have a problem with me. How do we start that conversation in a productive way?
Well, I think that, you know, that's a hard thing in conflict. When there's a conflict, there's something that you're not agreeing on. And usually when we go into one of those conversations, our intent is to make sure they see that we are right and they are wrong, you know, and that actually works against what is the most important thing in a hard conversation, which is really listening and making the person you're talking to feeling like you are making every effort to hear them, you know? And so I think that there is a way, there are ways to have conversations about real disagreements, consequential disagreements, but to have them in such a way that the person you're talking to doesn't feel like you're trying to, you know, bulldoze over their point of view or just win an argument. And so a few tips that I think are helpful is to think about before you have that conversation. If you know, if you're sort of aware that there's going to be a disagreement, think about what you want out of this conversation. You know, is it to understand maybe a little bit more about where the other person is coming from? Is it important to you? Do you feel like they haven't really grappled with how you feel or what your position is? So think about that. And then when you start the conversation, really pay attention to your pacing and your tone and say something like, I've been thinking about this disagreement we have, or, you know, I've been thinking about this thing. I feel like we need to talk about this. Is now a good time? And that way you're sort of signaling a couple of things. You're signaling that you'd like to talk in a concentrated way about this impasse that you're having. You're also making sure that they're in a space, you know, either, you know, emotionally, or they've got the time and also the energy to do this with you right now. And you're sort of beginning it with a nod to, like, you know, what they need. So you're not just saying, I need to talk to you about this right now. You know, you're creating the conditions for an exchange. And that's really what I think is the goal of any hard conversation, even when you come to the end of it and realize, oh, we still disagree. This is not something we're going to agree on. That's okay. But you want to feel like when you have a hard conversation that you've created a sort of avenue for you both to receive and give new information, like to really understand in a deeper way where the other one is coming from.
We're talking to Anna Sale, creator and host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money. Her new book is called Let's Talk About Hard Things. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Would you be willing to share the story of a hard conversation you've had or avoided or need to have? Do you have questions for our guest about how to do that? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Anna Sale. You may know her as host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money. We're talking about her new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things. Anna, you were just talking about introducing that difficult conversation with a careful tone, a well-paced tone. You talk later in the book, I think in the identity section, with someone who had problems with anger and impulsively using that anger on people around him and how he tried to get that under control. I thought that was really interesting, and it could apply to a lot of emotions in tough conversations. Can you share some of what you learned?
Yeah, thanks for asking me about that story. You know, the way the book is put together is it's part memoir of me having hard conversations. And then I also talked to a lot of different kinds of people who'd gone through really different things to understand, you know, what they wish they had said in a hard conversation and or what they did say and noticed that it opened up a new way of communicating. And he was one of those people who really did try and put a lot of energy into communicating in a different way. And I put it, he's in the identity section because I think often when we talk about identity and who, how to talk about identity and who's in charge of talking about identity, we often focus on, you know, people of color, Black people, Latino people, to be the people to sort of say, here's how you should talk about this. I wanted to include a white guy who was a little older, who was really trying to with new self-awareness, change how he interacted. And as you said, you know, he had a pattern of, you know, he was had a lot of anger. And when he would get in conflict, what he learned as a boy growing up and then in workplaces to be a yeller and to that would get his way, you know. That got results for him up to a point. And then he started having conversations with, you know, the HR departments and his bosses saying, like, look, you've got to change the way you're behaving. And it was also having some bad impacts on his personal life. He said at the end of his marriage, he realized he needed to change or he was going to really not get to have a relationship with his kids. So he, you know, through... For him, it was related also to a history of addiction, but through recovery meetings and support meetings, he really learned that for him, what he wanted to do was become aware of when he became agitated to pause. He has this little mantra. He says, pause when agitated. Because if he doesn't pause, he just goes into the patterns that he's been used to. He goes into the reactive, the yelling, the angry. So he tries to pause and have that self-awareness of like, okay, I need to slow down and I need to understand why I'm reacting this way. And just creating that pause, again, going back to pacing, gives him the space to sort of say, okay, what do I want to communicate here? How do I want to communicate it? And it doesn't always work, you know, old habits die hard. But he's learned now that when he does get angry, to quickly try to repair, and that is to take responsibility for how he behaved in a way that he didn't like. He has a line, he says something like, you know, I didn't talk to you in the way, I wasn't the person that I want to be. Which I think is really taking responsibility. Like I wasn't the best version of myself. And I'm sorry, I apologize. And also here's how I'm going to do it differently. And so he does, you know, it's this process of sort of before it happens, trying to again, get into that space of allowing for a slow listening driven exchange. And when it doesn't happen, to acknowledge it and to acknowledge his role in it and to try to repair and say, this is not how I want to communicate.
We're talking to Anna Sale about her new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things. The power of the pause, Anna, you give the advice in having conversations to, you know, let silence hang there sometimes and let people. And this is hard for me. I'm a live radio person. Silence is my enemy on the job. Talk about why in these hard conversations that's so important.
Well, you know, you know that like when there's a gap in the conversation, it creates a little tension, you know, and all of our instincts, whether we're a radio host or not, is to just jump in. Like what I find as an interviewer and in my life, I've tried this, to do this more in my personal life. If someone finishes a thought and then they're pausing and you're like, maybe they have more to say. If you just wait just another beat, they're going to feel that pressure to fill the space too. And what I think is so interesting is often when they come in with that next thought, it's layering in another layer of complexity or nuance or ambivalence. It's just a little messier often. And I really like that because it's an acknowledgement that stuff is not all figured out, you know? And when someone shares that second beat with you, you get to know them a little bit more, you know, instead of them presenting, here's what I've figured out, you know, finished, T's crossed and I's dotted. You then hear a little bit more about the process or what's not totally worked out. And it makes what's sort of an interesting thing is when someone is going into those second beats and third beats of saying things out loud that in the regular pitter patter of chit chat would sort of be crowded out. When someone is having that experience of kind of really talking and sharing, it feels that they notice how good it feels to be listened to, and then they will share more. And so it's this way of really conferring like respect and dignity to the person to just like make room for them to tell you more.
And Anna, I want to take a couple minutes to talk about when talking stops. You write about your first marriage, and you give other examples of this where there's a point where maybe you realize talking more isn't the answer. How do we realize we're at that point?
Yeah, I wanted to end my book, Let's Talk About Hard Things, with the idea of when to stop talking, you know, because I do think, you know, there is definitely a point where you've done it. You've done it enough. You've circled back around. You've tried to figure out the thing, and you can dig and dig and dig. And sometimes in my experience, in the end of my first marriage, I found that I thought if we just kept talking, we would uncover some fix. And I felt like we weren't doing it right, that we were not uncovering the fix for our marriage. And it was only in writing that part of the book, it's been more than 10 years, that I really recognized like, oh, we did the hard conversations in the way that we did a good job, you know, they were really sad conversations because what we were uncovering was that I wanted our life to look one way. I wanted a house. I wanted to have a family. I wanted to have kids. And my ex, what he wanted had really changed. He had become an artist. He was in film school, and he was imagining a future where he didn't have those sorts of like grounding obligations. He wanted adventure and travel, and that was a real mismatch. And we were both pretty clear. We became more clear the more we talked about it. But they were hard and sad conversations because we were having to admit that our marriage wasn't going to last forever. But sometimes that's how where hard conversations lead you. They lead you to new information that might not be pleasant. It might not but be the outcome you wanted. But it's what it is. And hard conversations help you look at that. And so when you get to that place at the end of a period of having hard conversations, it's okay to just say, okay, we've talked about this enough. And when you stop talking, then there's room for everything else that might come next.
We have just a few moments left. Anna, do we get better? You've done this a lot. You've had a lot of hard conversations or heard them from a lot of people. Is this a muscle? Can we exercise it and get better at it?
You know, what we can get better at is that feeling of discomfort. You know, the more you practice kind of saying, I don't know how you see it, but this is what I'm going through. Practicing that feeling of being vulnerable, or practicing that feeling of asking someone, you know, the slightly more open conversation than you would in the kind of like regular small talk exchange. When you get more comfortable in that space of just kind of, whoa, where's this conversation going to go? It gets easier. It gets easier to do because it's not so scary. You know, with more practice, they become a lot less scary.
Anna, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Sale is the creator and host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Let's Talk About Hard Things. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, the emerald ash borer has devastated trees in Wisconsin and around the country, but help might be on the way from a fungus. Find out more tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next is news, then the U.S. birth rate declined for the sixth year in a row last year. We'll find out how the pandemic impacted that. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.